Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Tuesday, December 10th, 2024. Sudanese ambassador in Washington calls on international agencies to help the people of Sudan.
Things have started to improve in different aspects, and they are gaining momentum. And I was surprised also to find the people, Sudanese people, very enthusiastic.
And the people of Ghana have spoken.
We officially have a president elect by the names of John Dramani Mahama, who is coming back for the second time. He lost a re-election in 2016. Finally, he managed to secure a comfortable 56.6% of the total vote.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Sudanese ambassador to the United States, Mohamed Idris, is calling on humanitarian groups to provide the much-needed relief items to families trapped by conflict inside cities in Sudan. Idris told me in an exclusive interview Monday that authorities in Sudan have opened humanitarian corridors for both local and international aid groups in the country.
Things have started to improve in different aspects, and they are gaining momentum. And I was surprised also to find the people, Sudanese people, very enthusiastic and living there. Though the challenges are many, there is suffering, yet they are trying their best to take care of their families.
And that sounds positive when you talk about things are changing. We are hearing news about people who are in Darfur, especially people who are displaced from their homes. Talk about Zamzam. Zamzam is being attacked by RSF on the ground and Sudan Armed Forces from the air.
Imagine, Sudan Armed Forces has never targeted a IDP camp, has never targeted a civilian area. The Sudan Armed Forces always targeting the RSF. It is the Rapid Support Forces militia who are taking people controlling the people, taking them as shields. The IDPs in Zamzam camp are the victims of the Janjaweed 2 decades ago. The same Janjaweed, which has been now rebranded, whitewashed to become the RSF, and they are reading from the same playbook. The people they displaced and forced out of their houses 2 decades ago, they are now again shelling them, targeting them, looting their very poor, the meager resources that they have. Mm-hmm. So it is RSF which is targeting the Zamzam and other areas, other civilian areas. Imagine Fashir, they have besieged the city and targeted it more than 150 times, always shelling. And now the biggest camp of IDPs in Darfur, and Darfur is Al-Fashir city. Yet the RSF are targeting Al-Fashir and targeting Zamzam and other IDPs camps also.
Yeah. And since this conflict broke out in April 2023, April 15, the narrative from the two sides, from your side as a government, is that this war has been imposed on you. And RSF is also saying the war has been imposed on them. But who imposed the war?
Let us counsel, seek what third parties are saying. Mm-hmm. We are now in the United States of America. There are many draft resolutions issued by the Congress condemning the RSF. telling us that the RSF is the one who instigated, who started this war. RSF was part of the Sudanese armed forces, and they decided to mutiny. They decided to take up arms and to overthrow the government and take control of the country. And this is an open secret now. And they themselves, they, in some of their speeches, some of their supporters have put it clearly that we want to control the country, we want to change the country, we want to rule the country. And they sometimes they just put videos, they themselves, you see. So, and there are many video, not only video videos, the international news and media outlets who have gone to the Sudan, who have been following what was happening in the Sudan, even before the outbreak of the war, they said that it was the RSF who started this war. It is the RSF who is committing atrocities against civilians. It is the RSF who is committing the crimes of rape, the violence against girls and women. It is the RSF which is occupying the houses of civilians. There are many narratives, but our narrative, we put it clear that to the international media and to Sudanese people also. We always, whoever use circles who are talking about what is happening in Sudan, depending on reports issued by activists, depending on reports issued by countries or peoples or organizations who have their own agenda, and they are well known to us and even to the international community.
Yes. Okay. The U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perello, he has been on the forefront to advocate for access to humanitarian groups into South Sudan to help those who are trapped into their houses in Omdurman, in Wad Madani, and other cities. And even there was an offer for dialogue. You did not show up on the table. The other groups were there. What is your plans for ending this peacefully? Because right now you're both armed, and the people on the ground are the ones suffering.
Okay, it is good that you mentioned the special envoy. We were together in Port Sudan 2 weeks ago, Ambassador Tom Perriello.
Yes.
He visited Sudan, he met the leadership of the Sudan, and he heard from them, you see. We expected him to go to Sudan ever since he was appointed as a special envoy for Sudan. But so late is better than never. Mm. He visited Port Sudan last month. We were there together, and it was put clear to him that Sudan is open for facilitating the delivery of humanitarian assistance to the needy people wherever they are, because these are Sudanese people. The government is interested in extending this assistance to them. And as you are speaking now, at that time, there was a shipment, as you are following, of humanitarian assistance from Juba Airport to Kaduguli area to Julud area. The government of Sudan also has agreed to open the corridor between Chad and Sudan along Adre area. Adre entrance. There are many other internal routes and airports: Al Ubayid, Kaduguli, Marawi, Port Sudan, and to deliver, and they are all open. But the real challenge is not the access. The real challenge are not the rules to deliver. It is the humanitarian assistance itself. There is no enough humanitarian assistance to be delivered.
That's Ambassador Mohamed Idris, Sudanese ambassador to the United States. He spoke with me on Monday at the Sudanese embassy here in Washington, D.C. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir fired the head of the nation's military, the police chief, and the central bank governor, according to an announcement made on the state-owned South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation. The announcement gave no reasons for their dismissals. It said Kiir had appointed Paul Ngang Majok as the army's chief of defense forces, replacing General Santino Wall, who was appointed as undersecretary in the Ministry of Defense and Veteran Affairs. The president also replaced his governor of the central bank. After a thorough review of votes from across the country, the Electoral Commission of Ghana has officially declared John Mahama candidate for the National Democratic Congress as the winner of the 2024 presidential elections. For more details, my colleague Yahya Swahib talked to Paul Ndiho, our VOA reporter in Ghana's capital Accra, who has been closely monitoring the election results.
Thank you, Your Highness. Yes, we officially have a president-elect by the names of John Dramani Mahama, who is coming back for the second time. He lost re-election in 2016. Finally, he managed to secure a comfortable 56.6% of the total vote. His opponent, Mahmoud Bawumia, scored 41.6% of the vote. But overall, I think the Electoral Commission here has to be commended for a job well done.
You are so very right, Paul. The declaration for the presidency was done by Jean Mensah, who is the chairperson of the commission.
Yes, Jean Mensah has been at the forefront of Ghana's Electoral Commissioner for a couple of terms now, done a remarkably good job to the extent that even the opposition, people who are coming into power, commended her for having pulled off one of the closest elections. Initially, it was a close election, but when things started trickling in, it was not even close. The opposition managed to win hands down. So to their credit, they say she did a remarkable job, and they wanted really Ghana to go forward.
And Paul, as you well know, Mahamudu Bawumia actually conceded a few days ago, right away, before even the results were coming in. Former President, President Akufo-Addo, yesterday, he has called to congratulate Mama.
Ghana is ahead when it comes to how they have conducted elections. They have had experiences being in power and outside of power. So it's usually a smoother transition when it comes to who wins and who loses. There is no question about that. What Mahmoud Bawumia did was a remarkable thing to the extent that he conceded before even the election results were announced. Why? Because they had their own internal polling. They looked at their own internal data, and that data could not change. Based on that data, their own internal data, they were able to say, we are not going to win this, therefore I have to inform the nation that this is it. I've come to the end of this campaign, I have to concede. And he did so graciously. Every single person that I've talked to, most of the people that we've met, from the observers to the ordinary person on the street, they commend him for doing that, for coming out even before the Electoral Commission announced the election results and conceded defeat. So people are looking up to him as a statesman, as a hero of sorts, because if he had not done that, there was definitely going to be tension or some kind of insecurity on the streets, because people are already gearing up to do whatever they need to do. But thank God that did not happen. He had the foresight of looking at it from that perspective and decided to concede before even the general election was called for.
And I guess what's left now, Paul, is the transitional process and possibly, you know, the inauguration.
Yes, that's going to happen very fast. According to President-elect John Dramani Mahama, the outgoing president, Nana Akufo-Addo, has invited the incoming president for a lunch and to start this transition on Wednesday, tomorrow. So they're going to have a sit-down, talk about the transition process, and as they await for the official inauguration in January. The outgoing president has invited the incoming president for a sit-down conversation at Jubilee House. So that's going to happen on Wednesday. And I think the two will talk about what is it that they can do to take their country forward.
That's Paul Ndiho, our reporter in Ghana, speaking with my colleague Yahes Wihib. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, rebels take control of Syria. What is next? Stay tuned for that story after our break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The fall of Damascus has raised concerns about what is next for U.S. troops based in the war-torn country who have been working with allies to keep Islamic State from resurging. VOA's Carla Babb has more from the Pentagon.
Syrians in Damascus reacting to a world without the Assad regime in power, a first since 1971. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
It's impossible not to be moved by the scenes of jubilation, the scenes of relief coming out of Syria. The end of this regime is a defeat for all who enabled its barbarity and its corruption, none more than Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia. So this moment presents a historic opportunity, but it also carries considerable risks.
Risk that U.S. forces aimed to mitigate this week, striking 75 Islamic State targets in central Syria with B-52 bombers, fighter jets, and A-10 combat aircraft, a move meant to ensure the terror group won't try to take advantage of the situation. Michael Rubin is with the American Enterprise Institute.
The real danger moving forward over the next 48 hours is that if the Islamic State escapes its prison camp at Al-Hul, then you could have thousands of militants, thousands of extremists, not only spreading across Syria and the Middle East, but also Turkey and Europe as well.
The U.S. military has about 900 troops in Syria to help Syrian Democratic Forces prevent Islamic State from resurging, with officials stating three primary interests now that the Assad regime has fallen. Here's Robert Wood, U.S. alternate representative to the U.N.
Our soldiers and personnel and all are protected. We want to make sure that our allies are safe and secure. We want to make sure that there isn't a humanitarian catastrophe.
The ousted former president has fled to Moscow. Analysts say the fall of Syria has weakened Russia along with Iran. Michael Rubin.
They've lost Hezbollah, or at least the ability to supply them. They've lost Syria. The question now is whether they can keep their grip on the Houthis, or whether other states in the region, Saudi Arabia, for example, are going to smell blood in the water.
The Pentagon says communication with allies is key. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has spoken with his Turkish counterpart about the ongoing Syrian developments. CENTCOM Commander General Eric Kurilla is in the region. He has met with Jordanian allies in Amman to discuss Syria, and officials say he plans to speak with other regional allies in the coming days. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Russian state media said Moscow has granted asylum to ousted Syrian ruler Bashar al-Assad, who reports say landed in Moscow after escaping from Damascus Sunday. The Kremlin was a key supporter of Assad and his government's brutal attempts to defeat rebels, and that memory may make it difficult for Moscow to regain its foothold in Syria, which until a few days ago appeared unshakable. Elizabeth narrates this report from Ricardo.
The flag of the Syrian opposition was raised at the Syrian embassy in Moscow on Monday, a sign that Russia has lost a key ally in the Middle East and must now rethink its strategy and alliances in the region. Kremlin granted asylum to the ousted Syrian leader and his family in Moscow and called for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss the matter. For Moscow, Assad's downfall is a serious blow. Kate Johnson is associate fellow at the Center for a New American Security in Washington.
Moscow's intervention in Syria was a way of showing it was a global power and that it had an ability to influence things outside of its immediate neighborhood. So I think in terms of the kind of geopolitical implications, it shows that Russia is less powerful than it might want to project to the rest of the world.
Moscow entered the Syrian war to support Assad in 2015, investing resources in the lives of Russian soldiers, which could now come to nothing. Analysts say it is others who stand to reap the benefits of Assad's downfall after Syria's 13-year civil war. Mark Hanna of the Institute for Global Affairs.
The big winner here is Turkey. Erdogan is thrilled, I think, that Trump has suggested he's going to remove American service members from Syria. Turkey's influence becomes more critical in that country. So Erdogan and Turkey, their stock rises while Russia's stock decreases here.
Kremlin officials say they are in contact with the new authorities, suggesting Moscow wants to reach some agreement to maintain its presence in Syria. But the role Moscow had in Assad's repression of Syria's people may be a memory difficult to erase. Neil Killiam with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House in London.
We saw Russia bombing hospitals, bombing schools, supporting Assad drop barrel bombs on the population, supporting Assad when he used chemical weapons. So I don't think any incoming government, whatever the composition is, whether it's HTS, whether it involves the Kurds, whatever, you know, whichever groups it includes, they cannot just suddenly forget the brutality that, you know, Russia inflicted upon the civilian population.
The rapid fall of the government was for many unimaginable a month ago, destroying a power structure that some people until recently thought was here to stay, and creating a new landscape that for now is unclear. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
Israel has pounded Syria with dozens of airstrikes in last 24 hours after the fall of the former president Bashar al-Assad, who fled to Russia over the weekend. Joseph Stigler, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies of the National Defense University, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the Assad regime has hollow and it could no longer rely on Russia for military support.
The regime itself had become, you know, very corrupted. They weren't merit-based. They weren't really unified for any sort of national goals or ideals. This is all a very patronage-based and politicized set of institutions. And so when the regime was threatened there really wasn't both the will or the capacity to respond. You know, it also underscores that the Assad regime was there because of the external support that it had. It never had legitimacy or popularity within Syria. You know, it was being propped up by the Russians primarily and Iranians. And with their being distracted in Ukraine and in Iran, within Iran and in Lebanon with Hezbollah, they were not able to come in and rescue Assad this time.
What about where things stand now? It seems to be a big question mark. Who is going to be in charge with these rebels that were able to take over? What happens to the government now that he just fled so quickly?
Well, it is a period of great uncertainty, and nobody really knows. Probably the rebels themselves don't know because they have been so focused on the military aspects. And so this will be a very fluid period in the coming days and weeks. You know, there's more than one rebel group, and so they are going to have to try to cobble together some sort of governing coalition. Indications are that the rebels have communicated to the respective ministries in Syria that they want them to continue to perform their functions, that they want a smooth transition, that there won't be there won't be uniform action taken against those working with the Assad government. Really, the focus is on those who were most in the political leadership. So, you know, that bodes well for a smoother transition. There does seem to be some dialogue happening between some senior members of the former government and the rebel leadership. And so I think it will remain to be seen whether the rebels are able and willing to live up to their pronouncements that they're, you know, that the purpose for their actions was to restore interest in the rights and the will of the Syrian people.
There's a lot of concern in the West, including the United States, that, you know, the ISIS is going to take over or some other insurgency group that is not friendly to the West. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, ISIS remains a priority for the region and internationally. By all accounts, ISIS was not a part of this movement. And so, and with the recent U.S. strikes against ISIS, clearly they seem to still be on the defensive. Of course, as we said, this is a fluid period. All actors in Syria are going to have to recalibrate their posture, you know, their coalitions. And I'm sure ISIS is looking at ways that they can take advantage, and if there's a vacuum, to try and fill it.
That's Joseph Stigley, Director for Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies of the International Defense University. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme. That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, December 10, 2024. We now take you to Yambio with the Tutu and her song, Sogote. Listening to Tutu with that song, Sogote. Sogote in Zande means hatred. And what you hear in the background is a xylophone, and the Zande call the xylophone Kwanimbo. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Gwen Uten, and engineer, Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mama,